We have a couple of House members who are in other committees this afternoon testifying, so it's not that they don't want to be here, but they're in other places. This is the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services, Tuesday, February 18th, 2003. It's a public hearing on House Bill 5030, the Department of Human Services, and with us today is Jean Thorne, the Director of the Department of Human Services, and also with Jean is George Naughton with Budget and Management Division, and Jim Neely is with Jean. Just some housekeeping. If there's anyone in the audience who has a cell phone, please turn it off so that it doesn't disrupt the proceedings. And yesterday we did name our pig. It's Rosie. And Rosie is there for a reason. Rosie is our fine when we use the acronyms, the alphabet soup, the alphabets, and the use of it is very prolific in this building. And the at the end of the legislative session, Rosie will be opened up, and all that's contained therein will be contributed to the Oregon Food Bank to assist and to feed the hunger. So with that, Sheila Baker, who is our staff person and who keeps me on track when I kind of go off sometimes, will give us our opening this afternoon.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I don't have anything to start you out with this morning. I think we will go into the continuation of the agency overview by the department director, and then George Naughton will do the summary of the governor's recommended budget. And then tomorrow we will begin our hearings on the first program area in the department, and that's the children, adults, and families.
Madam Chair, I'm Jean Thorne, Director of the Department of Human Services.
Jean, I have to comment. We did not coordinate with each other last night.
But may I say I admire your taste in clothes.
I admire yours as well, Jean.
That's right. Yesterday, we did kind of the high level, as I said, 20,000-foot overview of what it is that the Department of Human Services does, what kind of services we deliver to whom, generally, whether it's delivered through state agencies, through local government, through contractors. We talked about our budget, the portion of it that's related to general funds and how the general fund funds are used. And I'll reiterate, 87% of our general fund is actually used as match for federal funds or federal maintenance of effort. We discussed our federal funding sources and then also talked about the budgetary issues that we face, and how even the reliance on those federal funds means we also have to play by those federal game in terms of the federal laws and rules, and then discuss some of the other pressures that we have on our budget around the cost of health care, litigation, the fact that in economic recession is when the need for our services grows. What we'd like to do today is shift gears and have a discussion, and Jim Neely, who is the deputy director of the department, will lead the discussion around our performance measures, what they are, how we've been doing in terms of performance, what kind of impact we believe, or which of those we believe will be more severely affected by the budget. And then because of questions that have arisen from this committee, because it is so much a part of what the department is, I'd like to spend some time talking about our reorganization, what we had hoped to accomplish, where we are now. We are going through a process of assessing where we are, looking to see for mid-course corrections. And I'd like to share with you some of my concerns around our reorganization and the processes that we're going through to try to determine what further changes might be necessary. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Jim Neely, who can lead the discussion around our performance measures.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim Neely, Deputy Director. I think I'll start off on page 2 with a discussion of performance measures, and I'll apologize in advance and probably pay in advance as well.
Thank you very much.
Since the performance measure discussion has a lot of difficult terms in it. We have 28 key performance measures included in this in this document, and we take the performance measure business very seriously. In the previous divisions, I think every division had their own performance measure system. As the department has begun to look at it from a department-wide view, we now publish on a quarterly basis this book, which I'd be happy to get copies of the committee for if you don't already have this book. And this takes a quarterly look at all of our performance measures and have more detailed information about them. So I would encourage you to take a look at it if you have it. If you don't have it, I'd be happy to provide that to you. As part of the DAS process last summer, we took a long look at our existing performance measures and how would we get to 28 that we would want to include in this document. And it was rather a difficult process in looking at all of the things the department does, kind of trying to narrow that down to 28 performance measures. That took several discussions in cabinet and a lot of work by staff in the meantime. And I don't think it's realistic to suggest that 28 performance measures reflect the entire performance of the Department of Human Services. There are just too many programs. But I do think the 28 that we have chosen provides a pretty good representation of the important programs and the kind of work that we do at Department of Human Services. And a little later on in the process, I want to talk about all the other performance measures that we have in addition to these 28 and how you can see those. If you turn to page 4, we have a representation of our performance measure process. And at the top, we have 4 goals, and those are listed on page 1. But those goals are that people are safe, people are healthy, people are living as independently as possible, and that people are able to support themselves and their families. And from those goals, then we've developed 25 high-level outcomes. The department some time ago determined that everything that we had in terms of a high-level outcome would be our own statement, although 16 of those 25 high-level outcomes, and we have a listing of those a little bit later on, are either identical to or similar to Oregon benchmarks. So then below those high-level outcomes, we have the 28 key performance measures that we will go through shortly. And those 28 really are a subset of the other performance measures that we have, the intermediate-level outcomes also, as they're called. And we have a listing of those as well. And I anticipate that as you hear the presentations from the individual program areas, you'll probably want to get beyond the initial 28 and down into some of the other more specific outcomes that you'd like to talk about. Then at the very bottom of the chart, probably an innumerable amount of other information that we have available, data that measures everything from caseload to error rates to who's in what category of service. So we have a lot of things to look at. I'll try and just take a little bit of time to go through the 28 key performance measures for you. Before we do that, of those 28, and again, these were put together last summer in terms of the ones that we were choosing. We did a quick survey of the budget reductions that we've seen since the fifth special session, the November rebalance, House Bill 5100 cuts, and then the allocation reductions based on the December revenue forecast. And we compared those individual reductions to the performance measures that we had put forth. And we found that on average, about a little over six reductions hit every performance measure on average. Some as high as 19 reductions in a single performance measure. So one of the things that we'll continue to want to do as we go through the process and then into next biennium is to continue to look at the 28 performance measures and in particular evaluate the targets in terms of where we are budget-wise and make sure those still make sense. If you turn to Appendix B, which is about six pages back in the appendix, let me just tell you what we have there. First, we have the list of the performance measures and high-level outcomes. Then we have a list of the data sources that we use to get those, so you can see at a glance where that information comes from. Then we have, I think, what every or almost every budget presentation will have, and that's the write-up from the Department of Administrative Services about our performance measures. And we have a data summary that looks at some of these measures over time. And then finally, I think what was put in your book yesterday is a performance measure framework that lists the additional performance indicators that we have. But starting first with the first page there, it's known as the links form, or links to Oregon benchmarks. This form walks us through the various agency goals that I mentioned earlier, whether those goals have an attendant high-level outcome or an Oregon benchmark that they're related to. Then the individual key performance measure, what number it is, how long it's been a performance measure for us, whether it's an existing one, in which case there'll just be a dash there, or a new or a modified performance measure, the year 2000 value, the year 2005 target, and then who's the lead program cluster in terms of carrying these out. And Madam Chair, I would ask your guidance here in terms of just how closely you'd like to go through these. You want to step through them one by one, if you want to save some of these for the individual cluster presentations.
I think I'd like to save them, if it's all right with the committee, for some of the individual cluster presentation, because then it gives a reality to it.
Okay. I would then only suggest in the meantime, if you get a chance to glance over them and make notes about any particular areas that are of interest, and if you know ahead of time of areas of interest that either aren't included there or things you'd like to hear about, we'll be happy to do what we can in responding to those. Then let me just finish up here with a quick look at the DHS performance measure framework, which should be the last piece in Appendix B. This has a little bit more about definitions on the first page. Complete listing of our high-level outcomes, and then below that, starting on page 3, on the left-hand side of the page, the high-level outcomes.
Senator Gordley.
If we could stop for a moment, because we have several documents. I just want to make sure I'm looking at the right piece. What is the name of the document?
It is the DHS Performance Measure Framework, updated 127-2003. The first page looks like that, but yes, I believe that's the document.
Thank you.
I reference this because in addition to the 28 performance measures, key performance measures that we have, this also is a pretty good listing of the other performance measures that we routinely take a look at that we can give you more information about, and as well some of the other output and other indicator measures that we have available. So as you're going through the individual program clusters, I think this is a very good guide to let you know what it is we have in our repertoire in terms of things that we routinely take a look at and measure.
Madam Chair, before I move on to a discussion about reorganization, I just would want to reiterate, and I think after the you have the overview of the governor's budget and as we move into the individual presentations, the targets you see on in Appendix B were set prior to prior to having a governor's balanced budget. And so, as Jim noted, there are a number of reductions, and in Sheila's handout yesterday, she had bulleted the kind of the major program reductions that are occurring, and many of those will have effects and perhaps significant effects on our ability to meet those targets. And so I think as we move along and have a better understanding of how the budget will fall out, that we'll need to go back and see and what still might be achievable. I don't want to use the budget as being an excuse, but we do need to be realistic about which of these reductions will affect which of our performance targets. What I'd like to do, if that sounds okay to you, is move into a discussion about reorganization. As certainly the chair is aware, and others of you who served on this committee before, the department embarked on a very aggressive reorganization 2 years ago. And I'll say that having been in and out of the Department of Human Resources and now Services since 1976, I always say I came when I was 12, but there is no perfect organization. And I joined the department about 5 years after it was actually formed, 4 to 5 years after it was formed. And it was formed in the early 70s to try to bring together services.
And I was three.
You were three. Okay. Nice to know that. But to really try to bring together services that have been separately administered, and even in the late 70s when I was working in the director's office of the Department of Human Resources, one of my jobs was to work at the regional level and bring regional managers from the various divisions together to see how could we better plan, how could we better integrate services. So the process of integration is an ongoing process. It is not something that we can ever say we have now achieved it. Because the other thing that is clear is that with the amount of change we're undergoing, we can have achieved what may look like perfect service integration one day, and if funding for a service is reduced or eliminated, that means we have to go back to the drawing board in some cases and relook at that. And there is, I personally have seen, I don't know how many iterations of a reorganization of the Department of Human Services, and especially as I was in the department from 1987 to 1995, we looked at a lot of different models. And although the last 7 years I was in Governor Kitzhaber's office and was working on education issues and not human services, I know when the drawing of this reorganization was put up on the board in the governor's conference room, I said, well, I think that was the 1989 plan. One thing that as you move boxes around, especially in an agency of this size, that as you move boxes, you may be doing that to link them more closely with another service, but you may also cause there to be a delinking with a service that perhaps it was more closely linked with before. And from my perspective, how you move the boxes can help or can hinder your work, but in the end, it's the people in the boxes and the willingness for them to work together and try to work through processes that enable people to work across organizational lines within an organization and across organizations that I think makes the difference. When Governor Kulongoski, then Governor-elect Kulongoski, talked to me about taking this job, he specifically asked that I undertake a process or lead a process of really pausing and saying, where are we with the reorganization, and determining whether we need to make some mid-course corrections. This is a huge organization. It's the largest in state government. We've moved quite aggressively on this. And to really say, are we achieving what we hoped we would achieve? And what's working well? Where do we need to maybe make some changes from what we had originally had conceived? First of all, one thing I'd like to make clear, and I continue to reiterate it with staff through weekly emails that I send out, because I'm afraid that many people are interpreting this reassessment as being, oh, we're just going to go back to the 7 divisions and 2 or 3 program offices. We are not going back to the old structure. The old structure certainly was comfortable for many of us in terms of knowing where to go. I still have problems of figuring out, you know, where is this function now in the organization? But I think the concept of integrating services to clients is an important one. But service integration is not the same as reorganization. And co-location by itself does not necessarily mean that services would be integrated. So we need to keep those thoughts separate. And we need to look at how can we, if in fact we have clients having to go to multiple offices or who have multiple case plans, that doesn't make sense. So how do we have them have no wrong door to go in? How do we have one case plan that brings together the various types of services they may need as opposed to potentially have conflicting case plans? And so I'd like to just keep that out there, that that still is a goal. But having said that, we need to step back and we need to, I say there's 3 basic questions that we need to ask internally. We are going through all of our advisory committees and we've got lots of them who care to provide input on this, and anyone else out there. And I think, for instance, I think Ramona Foley, who's the Assistant Director for Children, Adults, and Families, had this discussion with some of the juvenile court judges at Multnomah County the other day. And we'll probably have it with our federal partners. And there's 3 key questions. What's working well? And we need to build upon that. We need to continue. I want to make sure whatever we do, we don't inadvertently throw out those good things that are happening as a result of reorganization. What could work well, but we may need to put some additional supports in place, and that or may need to tweak it in some way. So, for instance, conceptually, maybe some of the way we're organized could work well, but we need to increase our communication links or our decision-making processes. And where is it that we really need to step back and say, you know, this was probably, you know, we may have thought this was the way to go, but as we look at it more closely and we understand the implications of it, we need to reassess and maybe change what our original thoughts were. We have a lot of work on our plate right now, as you know. And we don't have time to have task forces or, you know, create new organizational structures to look at reorganization. We have lots of places we can go for input, and we're going there while we're going ahead and getting our work done. I really began the process of having individual conversations with the cabinet members, and now we're moving this out further to the various groups that I discussed. So anyone who cares to provide us that kind of input, we certainly want to hear it. I mean, if you want to send me an email, do that or give me a call. There's no formal process that you necessarily have to go through. Let me spend just a few minutes talking, though, about my observations of what I have observed in the reorganization. And these are my observations and in most cases, I hope, being reinforced by discussions with others, and also the concerns I have, because I do have a number of concerns. I don't have the answers to those concerns, but I guess I want you to know that they are areas that I know we need to address. First of all, we have, in the reorganization, not only did we merge some of our former program offices, but I think, importantly, we centralized a number of our administrative functions. In the past, we had, you know, 7 or probably 8 human resource shops. We had a number of contract shops. We had, every division had their own information technology shop. We had, different budget shops. And what that, on the one hand, what that allows, what that would allow is that those services could be more closely tailored to the needs of that individual program area. But what it didn't allow was for some consistency. And let me use human resources as an example. How we address classification issues, how we address discipline issues. There were inconsistencies throughout the department. And by bringing together these administrative functions, I think we are bringing a consistency, we're bringing an efficiency. We had, as you may recall, and Secretary of State's audit around contracting functions with some major concerns about how we were doing our contracting. That was done before we centralized all our contracting functions. And in many cases, we did have a half-time person in some program office who may not have understood all the intricacies and legalities involved in that. By bringing the staff together, we're developing an expertise. We're developing a way in which we can back the various programs up if there's a particular workload in one area versus another. We can have staff with a greater amount of cross-training. One thing, and I don't think I mentioned this, I actually came back to the department in October as the interim administrator of the Office of Medical Assistance Programs, and so had 3 whole months of observations before I moved into this position. But I do think that I saw some of the consistency. I saw that where we had staff, information technology staff assigned to the health plan, and they were part of our, even though they were part of the information technology section, they were part of our executive team. And as we were coming up upon some time crunches, they were able to access staff from some other parts of the IT staff from information technology, staff from some other parts of the department to provide some back. Up, we were able to get the work done. So I think certainly that has been helpful in enabling us to be more efficient and more consistent in some of our administrative functions. I think we are seeing, or I'm seeing some evidence of staff having more knowledge of some of the other programs. When you get into your 7 program silos, you can know that program really well and not really have a sense of what are some of the other programs or services that might affect clients. And by bringing together both centrally and in the field staff who may not have been talking with each other before, I think they're increasing their knowledge of those other programs, which in turn enables, whether at the central office, better planning and better management, or out in the field, better integration of the services and direct service to clients. I think our policy offices have pulled together some programs that should have been more closely aligned. We, in the past, had a separate office for mental health that was separate from the Office of Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs. In many cases, we have dual diagnosis, and we talked about that yesterday. We're getting that data for you, Senator Gordley. But they were separately operated and administered, even though in many cases you had the same contractors, perhaps, providing the services. We brought that together. I think in the area of bringing together the services to seniors, persons with developmental disabilities, and persons with physical disabilities, many of the concepts in terms of continuum of services, providing services in the least restrictive environment, the contracting, the waiver type of issues are similar. And so I think we've brought some of these together that had been separate before. And in discussions I've had with field staff, they say they are seeing more movement towards multidisciplinary staffing out in the field and seeing where our clients that have multiple issues and bringing together both from inside and outside DHS those personnel who may have an effect on those clients' lives. Now, as I move into the concerns, though, and I didn't go through the reorganization. I was gone during that period, and I talked with, I think almost all of our cabinet members were here prior to the reorganization and were part of the planning for it and then part of the implementation. And I know one of them, and I think the more I look at this, I think it's true. We got rid of our old infrastructures without really fully developing our new ones. And so as we, for instance, moved and centralized our budget staff, and budget had been linked more closely with the program offices before, we may have brought together budget in such a way to make budget more efficient, but we may not have developed the communication and the decision-making processes of the budget shop with the program offices. And I know I experienced, just in my 3 months before I became director, a couple of occasions where budget information about Office of Medical Assistance Programs and the health plan was shared with outside people before I had had a chance to look at it and before we had a chance to discuss some of the assumptions, and maybe some of the assumptions were not correct. So I think that as we tried to, I think we need to be very careful that we don't take our former program silos and turn them into function silos. We can have an excellent information technology shop, but if that shop does not support the business that we have at hand, then we are not really integrating to the degree we should. And I feel strongly that our support functions need to be that. They need to be supporting our programs and our service delivery and not be driving what it is that we do in program and service delivery. Having created the three policy offices and the field office, I think we need to do more work on providing linkages across those offices. We're doing that within the offices. I mentioned we've brought together programs that were separately administered. But many of our programs aren't that neatly tied. And I think I was especially cognizant because when I was formerly with the department as the head of the Office of Medical Assistance Programs, Medicaid is a cross-divisional program. The eligibility occurs in many parts of the department, and then the acute care part, which OMAP administered, has to link up with the long-term care part, which is administered elsewhere. So I think we have these, we brought together program offices, but we need to do more to link across them. A particular concern I have as the director is that I'm afraid the structure encourages accountability to flow up rather than down. And I would just as soon have accountability flowing down. The reason I say that is, again, from my experience when I came back to OMAP, that as the OMAP director, I was expected to be able to be answerable to you, the legislature, to be answerable to our providers in terms of whether they were getting their checks and they were getting them correctly. But yet, if there were budget issues that were being dealt with outside the program area, or if there were information technology issues that were part of getting claims processed, and unfortunately we weren't a high enough priority, the place to resolve that was with the director of the department. And so, again, I don't have an answer to that, but I think we need to somehow, as we look at reorganization, figure out how can we increase the accountability, knowing that the administrative functions are really operated or administered elsewhere. How can we increase the accountability of our program managers when they may not actually have the authority over all of the functions?
Senator Carter, let me tell you why I think you're on the right lines. When managers under you don't feel as if they have to be accountable for decisions they made, some of the more popular cases in this state comes to mind. And people didn't have to feel responsible. When I called into the state to try to find out some information, nobody felt responsible under the director's office. And I think the people of Oregon want better accountability. They don't. The director is not on the line on a daily basis. There's no way you can with nearly 10,000 employees. The buck has to stop someplace else. And I've always been a complete supporter of this agency because you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. And so, therefore, you need as many allies as you can get. But on the other hand, when things go wrong, if people down below don't feel that they have to be responsible nor accountable, then they don't have buy-in to the agency's mission, let alone their goals. Mm-hmm. In some kind of way, and I even said this to Gary before I left, and I said it to Bob while he was there. And you see, it doesn't work. And so people can go out in the field and do what they want to do, and then don't have to be accountable for it because you're going to have the answer to it. Where do you have buy-in? I think this is the wrong management direction to be going. I said it 3 years ago. I'm saying it again today. I said it when we changed before. We've never even given this agency, Madam Chair and members of the committee, a 7-year period of time. We changed this agency in 1993. We changed it again in 1997. And all the data shows that it takes from 7 to 10 years to show success in any particular environment, and yet this agency hasn't had a chance to because of so many drastic changes. So I hope somewhere along the line you can build an accountability that does not go all the way to the top, but that makes people more accountable on the ground.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Carter. I certainly, as director, want to be able to have accountability throughout the agency. And I think, you know, one of the cabinet members said to me, there are no buffers under the director. And I one of the things I said to cabinet when I first came in is I want the face of DHS to be more than me.
Right.
I mean, we need to have people throughout the department who have the authority and the responsibility and to carry out their work. Moving along, I would say two, again, with some of the concerns I have. There are two really key concerns that I've tried to at least provide some action. I'll talk in a moment about some of the actions today. But two key issues that certainly bubbled up to me and bubbled up to the transition team. And I actually, the first one is one when I first saw the organizational structure I was concerned about, and that is the separation of our policy from our field offices. We have policy and program being developed and administered in children, adults, and being developed, and there's oversight in our children, adult, and families cluster, yet the staff who actually carry it out go through a different line, a chain of command, who are in the community human services. It's not that that can't work, and I don't want to just leave it with children, adults, and families, because the same could be said for seniors and people with disabilities and health services. It's not that that structure can't work, but you have got to have the linkages between all of those. Because if the policy and program staff are doing that in a vacuum and not knowing what the effect's going to be in the field, and the field's not being able to provide the feedback to the policy and program staff of what's working and what isn't, that is not an efficient and effective way to operate. If questions have to go up and across, again, that's not an efficient and effective way to operate. I recognize the need for consistency, but I'm very concerned about having that separation. And we need to, if we continue that separation, we need to build in the communication linkages and the decision-making linkages. So it's very clear where is their input, where are the feedback loops. The second thing I'm very concerned about in the field, and that was evidenced and heard from a number of people, as we brought together primarily our former adult and family services and services to children and families, and a lot, we have some other functions in the field, vocational rehabilitation and some of our senior services. Child welfare is different. And I've been in and out of the department for many, many years, and I've said this to staff. I probably was heard on more than one occasion talking about, the whining staff at Children's Services Division, the social workers.
Now, I came from that division.
That's right, and I actually worked there with you. Actually, Madam Co-Chair, I worked there with you for a few months. I don't have it on my resume, but I do have.
And Madam Chair, were you one of those whining people?
I'll tell you I didn't whine.
All right. No. But having said that, when you're dealing with lives of children, when you're dealing with children who potentially are being abused or neglected, that is very different than the work of trying to help someone become self-sufficient. All of the work is very important, but it is different, and we need to recognize those differences. My concern is that in the way in which we approached reorganization and in the staffing, and some of the staffing, frankly, someone pointed out to me, some of it really probably even predated reorganization. It may have been part of some other budget cuts that occurred. I think in many ways we may have left child welfare staff in the field without adequate supervision and adequate support. The example I've been given many times is that we eliminated the office managers. And these were the staff who supervised clerical, who made sure that when there were leaks, they got taken care of, or if there was a break-in or a security issue, or desks were broken. We eliminated those those managers, and we put those responsibilities on the other supervisors. And what I am told has happened quite frequently is that rather than the child welfare supervisors really spending their time providing the clinical supervision, they're dealing with these other issues. And, you know, taking care of the, finding someone to take care of the toilet that's overflowing. That's not a good use of our staff. It's not an appropriate use of our staff, especially in an area like child welfare. And so I think that as we brought staff from various disciplines together, we need to recognize we are not trying to have generic workers. We need to recognize the specialties that different people bring, and we need to provide the kind of clinical supervision that they may need in order to carry that work out. Overall, I would say probably my biggest concern, besides all of those, it was surprising to me. I was very surprised when I came back to the department. Is that I think in the zeal to move reorganization forward, there was a message, whether it was given explicitly or perceived, of keep your head down, don't speak up. If you have concerns about this, too bad, we're moving forward, get on the train or get off the train. Now, I know enough to know you're not going to get 9,500 employees and all of our stakeholders and all of you together and come up with something we all agree on. I also know that there are issues that you can discuss to death, and there are going to be disagreements. On the other hand, our staff are—I mentioned specialties that staff bring—and they are out there throughout our department, whether it's in the field, in the state hospital, in our central offices, and they're on the front lines in various kinds of front lines, and they have ideas. They can see potential impacts, and we need to know as we move down a road what the potential implications are of what we're doing. One of the things I asked our cabinet in my first meeting with them, I said, "If we're going to have to move fast on a lot of things here, especially in the coming months." And I said, you know, if you see, and I tend to be a person who may jump to decisions instead of going through lots and lots and lots of process, because I recognize the importance of process, but a lot of times we can't afford a lot of time for process. But I said, if you see either me going down a road or us as an agency going down a road and you don't think that we've fully considered the implications of what we're doing, I not only want you to speak up, I expect you to speak up, because we all bring different expertise, and we need to say, have you thought about such and such? Maybe we have, and we realize this may happen, but we need to go down this road anyway, but maybe we haven't. So some of the actions, I guess there are kind of three actions that I've taken to date while we're continuing this process of reevaluating where we're going. The link, as I said, the link between our policy and field offices and the issue around child welfare were of immediate concern to me, and I felt we couldn't wait to look at some of those issues. And so what we have done, yesterday I realized after I went through the organization chart, I mentioned who the assistant directors were for the three program clusters and didn't mention as I went through the other pieces. Ramona Foley, who will be with you here beginning tomorrow, who is the assistant director for Children, Adults, and Families, and has a very long, I shouldn't say very long, back, she's probably listening, very long background in child welfare, but really is
very long draw.
Oh, yeah, and a very long draw from South Carolina, is really very well respected in child welfare. I asked Ramona to not only lead Children, Adults, and Families, but also for the next 6 months to serve as the acting assistant director over the field. Mm-hmm. And she might even, I'll share with you the story. I called her while she was at home with 103-degree fever, so she said she was probably delirious at the time when she agreed to accept this. But I asked her to specifically look at two things. How can we better link our policy and field? And it's not just Children, Adults, and Families and Community Human Services, even though that's where most of the linkages occur, but also with our other program offices. And secondly, how can we provide better support to child welfare, better supervision to child welfare over the coming months? So I've asked her to take on that role for about the next 6 months or so to, again, try to see what's going on. I know she and she has also brought in as her, we have a lot of acting PR, her acting deputy assistant director for the field, Jerry Burns, who had been our manager of Multnomah County Service Delivery Area, to assist her in this. And I know they, I mean, in the last 2 weeks, they've been to Lane County, they've been to Jackson County, I believe, they've been to Douglas County, and have really spent time talking with all the staff, talking separately with child welfare staff, to get a better understanding of what are some of the decisions we've made, where should we maybe rethink some of those decisions, what are some of the concerns. So I think putting Ramona Foley over both those areas certainly will help us over the next few months kind of figure out where we go from there, and hopefully also help us more immediately address concerns around child welfare, because those are certainly critical issues. The second thing I've worked hard at it is really trying to establish a tone, whether it's through my emails that go out to at least 9,500 people, I don't know who else, and in discussions we have with cabinet and then further, of saying we need to have a tone. We need to establish a tone that says we want and we encourage feedback. This is very difficult work people are doing, and especially in these times. If we are asking them to be on the front line with clients as we go through these reductions, and we're also telling them, and don't open your mouth, that's not healthy for an organization. So we need to hear from them. We want to encourage that feedback. And then we want to act. We want, even if people have ideas, and maybe the ideas really, when you look at them, aren't going to pan out, they need to understand why. We then need to provide the feedback to them so staff and others understand why we're making the decisions we are, even if they may not agree with them. The third issue really is we need to look at major, and this came before the missive last week from Gary Weeks on behalf of Governor Kulongoski. We really need to look at proposed major expenditures in light of the cuts that are occurring. We are not in normal times, and so I'll use this example since you probably read about it yesterday. We have 9,500 employees and we go through chairs, okay? And maybe at normal times it would make sense to buy some new chairs. But given the kinds of cuts that we are going through right now, even if in the whole scheme of things we're not spending, that's not a lot of money, we need to really step back and say, how critical is this to our getting the work done right now? And so it's a perception issue, but it's also a very real issue. We need to see where can we, you know, when you're $140 million down, it kind of sometimes $15,000 doesn't seem like a lot. But we need to carefully look at how we're spending our money and really say, how critical is this to doing our business?
Senator Carter.
Gina, I'm glad you brought that one up. We called our phone today in Northeast Portland, the Northeast Portland office. We have 15 complaints already about DHS not being able to take care of medical benefits and other things that they can buy new chairs. But also in the newspaper today, as well as other phone calls in our office here at the building, was the state even just buying all this new furniture and stuff? We're under watchful eye these days, and I know it calls for wisdom on some of our parts, but this is just not the environment to be purchasing objects. And yes, we want to have good, healthy environments, and some are work-related and that kind of stuff, but somewhere along the line, wisdom has to prevail. So this was already on my paper here, but somewhere along the line, wisdom has to prevail, and people are not going to take us very kindly for doing this kind of thing.
Gene, I'm going to make a comment because I know this did not happen on your watch.
Right.
And I know that also there are things that happen in this building and that plans have been put forth long before we hit this crisis. And, you know, I commend you for saying to your staff as we go forward to be very conscious of the purchases. But I have to put on the record, I know you were not here when this was purchased, and we weren't in the same kind of budget and environment, and I just need to say that. And as well as members of, that had approved budgets by this panel, or by legislators who approved budgets that were responsible for this, it was before there was this economic crisis. And so I need to say that. I also need to say something else, because Jean has done a tremendous job in assessing where the agency is after coming in for a very short period of time. And I'm going to reiterate a comment I made when we passed the reorg bill, that one, it took 30 years to get the department at the level at where it was when we passed that bill. It is it should not be our expectation that to do the reorg, that it's done in 1 or 2 or 3 or 4 years. Gene, I just want you to know. I think that I know that it takes time in order to put systems and things in place, and that you can't, you nor Bobby nor anyone should be expected to have all of the provisions within side of the statute completed. And also, I also know that you're under, when I look at the integrated services and the IT piece that was supposed to go there, those dollars you do not have in order to complete that piece. I'm saying this so that the expectation from this body isn't there, because their dollars are not there to complete some of the goals and objectives that was set out in the legislation. So, but I just wanted to give you the assurance that this chair recognizes what you're up against, and she appreciates all the work that you've done in a very short period of time.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. As I mentioned to you earlier, apparently, I think, they're gone. There's some residents in clinical psychology or psychiatry who were here today, and I didn't know if they were. I wanted to meet them as long as they didn't want to practice on me for taking this job.
I'm also glad that you recognized the child welfare piece.
That's right. I think just to summarize.
Madam Chair, I wanted to make a comment too, and I want to thank Jean and her staff for what they've done in DHS to change a significant attitude. Jean, you know that I brought this to you, and I'm sure other people did too, that people working for agency were actually proscribed from talking to their state representatives about certain issues after they talked to them and were in fear of their jobs or being reassigned as a result of it. And the need in this kind of a change for constant feedback over and over again on these issues, you well explained. Mm-hmm. So that while you make these changes, it's done in a way that this has least impact in a negative sense on people, because there will be some negatives. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't make change without some negatives. But I really want to tell you I appreciate what you and Ramona have done to work in my county to relieve some of that pressure and to let people know that they can talk to their state representative, state senator, without fear of retribution from the agency. And I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bates. I think just to summarize where I hope we'll go with reorganization in terms of timelines, as I told the staff, our immediate focus needs to be on getting the work done at hand. We can't be distracted by reorganization. We have too much on our plates right now. And at the same time, I've said if there are things we're doing out in the field that make sense and not going to cost us more and it makes sense from the client perspective, for heaven's sakes, keep doing it. Don't say, oh, we need to stop. But I also, besides gathering input from the various groups I've talked about, I think I know that the budget that comes out of this legislature will mean drastic changes in much of what we do. We're just starting to experience that now, and I think as you hear from Mr. Naughton about the 0305 budget, almost all the reductions continue and are even deeper. And so what actually comes out of this legislative body in terms of the services and the programs we deliver, that by itself will have an influence on how our organization needs to be structured. So I haven't set a specific timeline, but in my own mind, I think that By this fall, we will have a better sense of what it is we're delivering. We'll have a better sense of how could we better link our field and policy offices. We'll have input from a variety of places on those three key questions that I mentioned. So at that point, I would anticipate we'll take a look at where do we go from here. We'll be coming back and visiting with the emergency board. I think that you probably had a report at every emergency board about how reorganization was going. So the plan would be to come back and visit with you. And I would just, in the meantime, encourage any of you who have concerns or comments or input, we want to hear that. And so please feel free to give me a call or send me an email or call me over, and we can talk more about that. That is really the conclusion of our agency overview, and I think from there it was the turning to George Naughton, unless you had, and if you wanted to wait and handle questions after George was done.
Well, we'll hear from George, and then if there's questions, we'll entertain questions.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am George Naughton with the Department of Administrative Services Budget and Management Division. You will see two of us working on Department of Human Services, myself, and to my left, two rows back, is Pam Teschner. She is the other Budget and Management Division analyst that you will see dealing with these issues. You should have in front of you a presentation that we have prepared. Let me start just by saying that this is an extremely high-level overview, just given for your edification as far as overall overarching principles and some large themes that you may see. What you will have, I'm going to give you a presentation.
George, mm-hmm. Just for the sake of the members who are here, so that they understand that your presentation and with the 0103 and the governor's proposed 0305 does not take into consideration of the new budget figures revenue shortfall, so that you understand that. So, okay, thank you.
Madam Chair, to clarify that, what you are going to see in our presentation is simply focused on the 0305 budget that was developed in the month of December. Since that time, we've had some changes since then. One, we had another revenue forecast came out in December that had a reduction of $112 million for the 0103 biennium. Then we had another revenue forecast that will be coming out at the end of this month that you're all familiar with. But there have been a number of changes since the time that this governor's budget was first put together.
I guess I wanted to impress that because these figures here, these are not included.
That's correct. If I start with the first page of our presentation, you should see a table there. It starts with a budget comparison across different columns or time frames. What I'd like to point out here is that at the close of the session, the 2001 legislative session, this budget for the Department of Human Services had $2.5 billion in it of general fund and $8.5 billion of total funds. At that time, the Department of Human Services made up about 23% of the state general fund. The middle column that's titled 2001-03 through the fifth special session includes all the legislative changes that happened up through April of 2002. And you'll see that number, you'll see an erosion of the general fund, but an increase in total funds. And there are some issues that we're going to have to talk about with you and educate you about a variety of different programs within the department, sometimes that work counterintuitively. The other column that you'll see, the 2003-05 governor's budget, that is what is proposed, as we said, that was developed in December of 2002. And you will see that the governor's budget includes $2.2 billion, or a $300 million decline in general fund, and a total funds of $8.58 billion. What I would point out is, as I mentioned, at the close of session 2001, the Department of Human Services made up about 23% of the state general fund. In the governor's budget, they make up about 20% of the state general fund. So this budget that you'll see in front of you has a larger proportional cut to it and has a smaller piece of the overall pie than it has at the end of the 2001 session. Now, the other thing I'd point out for you, again, to get to that counterintuitive nature of things, the far right column is changes from the governor's budget, comparing that to the 2001-03 legislatively approved budget through that fifth special session. You'll see that in that comparison, general fund has gone down by 5.6%. Total funds have gone down by 6.6%. But at the same time, you have an increase in federal fund resources, especially in the non-limited area, of 9.5%. There are some programs within the department that are funded strictly and solely with federal funds, and we maximize those as much as we can. That is primarily food stamp dollars that come and are pass-through monies. But you will see as we talk through various programs, especially when you get into the community human services, that the increase in some of those programs has a direct impact on the number of staff the department hires, and you'll see increases overall, and you do see increases in the number of staff in the department, and those are linked. The next page is a pie chart that highlights for you the importance of federal funds. Federal funds make up about 60% of the department's budget when you add in the non-limited food stamp federal funds and the limited federal funds as primarily Medicaid and temporary assistance to needy families, or TANF monies. General fund makes up about 26%. And then the other fund categories are primarily, or the largest individual pieces, are tobacco tax monies for the governor's budget. It was Representative Bates yesterday asked for a comparison of the tobacco tax and tobacco settlement funds that were in the 01-03 biennium versus the 03-05 biennium. And actually, we've had a decline. For the 01-03, we had $497 million of tobacco tax and tobacco settlement funds in the budget. For the governor's budget for 03-05, it's down to $400 million. And the primary reason for that is we've had an increase in tobacco tax funds, but there are no tobacco settlement funds in the budget for the Department of Human Services. If I can turn to the next page, this is an overview of just where the budget is, or the governor's budget. As I mentioned, the total funds shows a 6.6% decline from the 2001-03 legislatively approved budget through the fifth special session. Thematically, this budget is very simple to explain. It continues the cuts that were included in, or as the outcome of, the failure of ballot measure 28. It also eliminates additional funds by eliminating all inflationary and utilization increases. And then it takes additional reductions specified or targeted at the Oregon Health Plan, which include eliminating adult dental, creating a prior authorization program for pharmaceuticals, and changing the way that we reimburse pharmaceuticals through pharmacies. The next page, page 5, highlights again for you, which you've seen in various iterations, the variety of programs the department operates or funded within the governor's budget. For the most part, we will continue to serve people with developmental disabilities. We will continue to have self-sufficiency programs. With the Department of Human Services, we continue to serve those populations. We simply serve less people, or we serve them with reduced resources. So overall, the core programs are still there. It's just that we're doing a lot less of what we've done in the past. If I turn to page 6, and this will give you a comparison of how much total funds goes for the different clusters that you will see in front of you. And again, as was highlighted by Legislative Fiscal Office and by the director of the department, the importance of seniors and people with disability services and health services. Total funds, they make up over 70% of the department's budget, and they make up, likewise, a similar over 77% of the general fund for the department. Senator Morse yesterday, as you were discussing, I think it was Appendix B, that listed out how many clients were served in each of the different programs. You'll see that seniors and people with disability services, which makes up about 24% of the budget, of total funds budget, and about 33% of the general fund budget, serves only about 8% of the clients that the Department of Human Services sees overall. Whereas health services, which makes up about 46% of the total funds budget, serves over 70% of the people that come in to see the Department of Human Services and look for service from them. There are some real clear and very explainable reasons why that is. Seniors and people with disability services, for the most part, provides 24-hour residential care and a lot of other in-home supports that are very, very intensive. So the cost per person in those programs is significantly higher than what you may see in self-sufficiency or even in the Oregon Health Plan. The next page, 7, highlights again for you, as we've all pointed out, that about 80% of this budget flows out of the department as pass-through monies to either private providers, private nonprofit providers, or county partners who are providing the direct service. For the most part, the programs within the Department of Human Services, you are not directly administered by state employees. The employers are primarily out in the private sector or our local partners. On page 8, this begins a walkthrough, which is really, I guess, the last major section of my presentation, and this is the guts of the budget. This is going to be a very high-level overview. I have only highlighted the ones that are significant that you're going to have context for as you see the next presentations over the next several weeks or months, I would guess. So that you're aware of the outline of this, you will see a similar presentation as you're seeing from me when we go into each one of the individual clusters. So the information I'm providing you here is a department-wide look, and will probably overwhelm you with the magnitude of the dollar changes we're talking about. The individual detail will be coming behind as we talk about each individual cluster, and we will lay through for you each of the individual cuts that's involved or the ads that you'll see there. But if I start on page 8, again, the legislatively adopted budget was $2.5 billion and $8.5 billion total funds. The legislatively approved budget through April 2002, you'll see that there was a net increase of 20.7 general fund. $19 million of that was second year funding for the Staley program. So it was not really an increase above what the legislature had approved coming out of the close of session. The funding was simply sitting in the emergency board. What I do want to highlight for you is an increase of $571 million of total funds, which is primarily food stamp increases. It's increases in funding for the Medicare upper payment limit, which is pass-through monies. There are a number of things that flow through this budget outside of general fund, and that's simply to show for you or give you an order of magnitude. There's a lot going on in this budget outside of general fund. Base budget, this is one that I'm sure we will have lots of discussion about, especially when we talk about some of the variety of programs. The first base budget adjustment is an increase of about $113 million of general fund and $130 million of total funds for position actions or compensation adjustments. This is more than just increases in compensation and salary increases for state employees and merit increases. This also includes a variety of actions where we have refunded positions, for example, with the Medicare upper payment limit. In order to finance those changes in the 2001-03 biennium, we had to borrow money from personal services in order to initiate the payments out to nursing facilities. A very complicated process, and I do not want to get it in front of this committee. Just want to highlight that there are some massive changes that go on in some of these programs that are going to be underneath the surface, and I would certainly be willing to try and explain them to you outside of here. But if I try and get into it in this discussion, it will take the rest of the afternoon, and I will lose myself more than likely. I highlight that it's a very large change that's happening there. The next page, page 9, essential packages. There are a series of incremental adjustments that we make to the budget that had in prior times been referred to as current service level adjustments. That terminology is out of vogue now. I highlight it for you because we will show changes to it, and these are the building blocks that you'll see. The first one is package 020. Those are phase-in and phase-outs. In this program, it saved $127 million of general fund, where we've eliminated those resources out of the budget because they were the one-time costs or one-time transfers that no longer are needed. Package 030 are the inflationary increases and the utilization increases. $400 million of general fund and $1 billion of total fund tied up in that line item alone. $300 million of that general fund increase is specifically the Oregon Health Plan or medical assistance-related programs. I will also highlight that the governor's balanced budget eliminates these inflationary and utilization increases, and you'll see a package down below that mentions that, and we are going to have significant discussion, I am sure, about this particular issue. Package 040 is something that we refer to as mandated caseload adjustments. and that is that the Department of Human Services, probably more than any other state agency, the programs that they administer, many of them are entitlements that are given to us by the federal government. Where the federal government says, if this person meets our eligibility criteria, you will serve them. And that is primarily the programs that you see listed down underneath this bullet. The Oregon Health Plan, long-term care for seniors and people with disabilities, most of our child protective services or child welfare programs, and then there are a series of things that either are settlements of lawsuits or threatened legal action, again, that we refer to as a mandated caseload. Those would include civil and criminal commitments to either our developmental disability or mental health systems. There are crisis services for adults with developmental disabilities. And finally, the food stamp program, which, again, food stamps are entirely funded with federal funds, but we pick up the administrative costs of those. Page 10, the first item on there is package 050. This is a package related to fund shifts, either where we're getting additional federal funds or less federal funds or other funds that offset or increase general fund usage. You'll see here that there's a $36.1 million general fund reduction related to this package, primarily because the Medicaid match rates became more favorable to us as our economy worsened relative to the national economy. So with every good news, there's bad news as well, or vice versa. The next piece that I'll talk through is what we refer to as policy packages. The first one is package 070. Revenue shortfalls include a variety of things, either where there are fee increases that the current fee structure is not sustainable to continue the programs into the next biennium, or where there are one-time resources that will disappear. For example, the tobacco tax, there is currently a 10-cent temporary tax for cigarette packages that is projected to sunset during the 0305 biennium, which creates a loss of revenue. Typically, especially with that instance, we will have a policy package later on that proposes restoration of that one-time tax. You also see a variety of proposed fee increases when we get into the details of this budget, where public health programs have asked for fee increases to support or restore some of these losses. The next four packages, packages 081 through 084, are really related to legislative action that was approved during the 2001-03 interim. Those packages, and as they're laid out here, are the roll-up impacts of what the legislature approved at either emergency boards or special sessions. And the one, I guess, that I would highlight for you is package 084 is the first time that we had a major or significant changes to the Department of Human Services budget. At that point, there was a rebalance plan for the Department of Human Services, and you'll see that through a combination of reduced caseload forecasts at that November rebalance, and because of programmatic reductions, there was a net reduction of $158 million general fund and $308 million total funds. Those reductions, just so that folks are clear, the reductions that were included in the November rebalance plan flow through into the 0305 biennium. Package 091 is the first of the major reduction, two major reduction packages that you'll see in this budget. That is, package 091 is referred to as our fifth special session, section 2. As all of this committee will remember, the fifth special session, House Bill 5100, there were two sections to it. The first one were specified reductions that we included in package 082, and then there was a series of unspecified pro rata reductions to state agencies, which ultimately became the ballot measure 28 reduction list. Package 091 simply rolls forward all of the ballot measure 28 reductions into the 0305 biennium. That totaled a reduction of $422 million of general fund and $834 million of total funds. And again, it's simply carrying forward those cuts. Let me highlight at this point that since the time that that list was presented and prepared and built into the governor's budget, there have been changes to that list. For example, at the time we created the governor's budget, the ballot measure 28 list for seniors and people with disability services included a cut down to survival priority level 5. At this point, the only thing that's built in is survival priority levels 10 and above. So when we get to work session, ultimately, with these programs, there's going to be a time of truing up and making sure that the cuts that are in the budget for the next biennium match up to what's actually reduced in 0103. The next major change is package 092. Those were the changes even after we rolled up the ballot measure 28.
No, I mean, yes. Can we just go back for just 1 minute? I got some calls today regarding people who like had sold their property and everything and put their money into the system for Medicaid purposes and in nursing homes. Is that when I heard George say that you bought down to level number 5? Did I hear that right?
I think Senator Carter, when we had back in November, when we initially put together our list for House Bill 5100, mm-hmm. we had assumed we would meet the target for the former Senior Disabled Services, because we're still on that organization, by going down from prior to February 1, we covered levels 1 through 17. In order to meet the target, we had proposed going down and eliminating levels 5 through 17. As we entered into further discussions with the federal government, it was clear that, because this is Medicaid, that was not going to be feasible. We went back and forth with a different, we tried to look at just based on an income standard. That wasn't going to work. And so under the current plan, we did eliminate the coverage for levels 15 through 17 on February 1 and are scheduled to eliminate coverage for levels 10 through 14 as of April 1. And in addition to that, there was a provider rate reduction, which has not yet been implemented because it requires legislative approval. And we still haven't met our target really for the savings we have to the 0103 target savings. So I think what George is explaining is that we had like three iterations of our House Bill 5100 cuts. We had the initial one, then when the December revenue forecast came along, we moved some of the 51 November rebalance that took some of our 5100, so we had to go back and put some new ones on there. When the December revenue forecast came along, we then moved some of our cuts that were on 5100 to cover that allotment reduction, and then the final list of reductions that occurred because of the measure failure of measure 28 is different in many cases than what the governor's budget may have been based on because we've been through these changes.
So are we now preserving only 1 through 5?
No, we would currently in 0103 we'll be preserving levels 1 through 9. The governor's budget, because it had been based on what we had earlier planned, would have only preserved levels 1 through 4.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
But we'll have to deal with that as we move into
as we go through this process.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Madam Chair, at the end when we did the budget and the governor developed his budget, even after we continued all of the cuts related to ballot measure 28, there still was not significantly deep enough to reach the level of reductions that we needed for 0305, which is why you'll see a package 092, which are additional reductions beyond that amount, and they are very significant in nature. What the governor chose to do is the largest single cut is eliminating inflationary and utilization increases, which for some of these programs, as I mentioned, were very significant rate increases. The Oregon Health Plan, which we will talk about a couple of weeks from now, the new per capita increases for managed care plans is close to 28% for the 0305 biennium, for the biennial period. So what this package does is eliminates all of those increases, whether they be related to inflationary cost increases or utilization changes, and we know that that will have significant impacts on access. There is a separate group through Representative Westland's committee that is looking about what does that mean and what does that kind of system look like. So that discussion, I'm sure, will be alive and well through the rest of this session. There were other additional cuts that were made beyond the utilization and cost increases. There were specific targeted reductions made to the Oregon Health Plan, and you will have those listed there. Adult dental services were eliminated for the Oregon Health Plan. There was implementation of prior authorization for pharmaceuticals, and there was a change in pharmacy billing practices. That really, those two packages together, you will see equate to about over $800 million of general fund reductions to this agency's budget, and close to almost $2 billion of total fund reductions that would not be flowing through to communities because of reductions being proposed here. On the last page, page 12, there are two policy packages I want to highlight for you that were of significance enough that I thought it was important for you to be aware of. The first one is the Department of Human Services is midway through a change in its Medicaid Management Information System, system that is needing to be replaced and was begun in the 2001-03 biennium. There is $7.5 million of general fund and another about $63 million of federal funds related to continuing that project in the 2003-05 biennium. There's a package to continue that, or that continuation is included in the governor's budget. Package 162 also transfers the child support program, which had been part of our self-sufficiency program within the Department of Human Services, and transfers that to the Department of Justice. That transfer was begun during this biennium. This package completes that process. There are also a variety of other smaller policy packages that I didn't want to highlight for you here because they're relatively small, related to fee or revenue changes, primarily within public health programs that are primarily fee-based. There are also some small revenue enhancement packages around estate recoveries. But again, some of them are minuscule in the large picture of things, less than $100,000. And then finally, new programs and governor's investments. I think, as all of this committee is aware, the governor lessened the ballot measure 28 impacts on our child protective services or child welfare program by adding back $5 million of general fund. We still continue cuts through ballot measure 28 to the child welfare system. It's just the governor chose to lessen some of those in an area that was of critical need, as the director has pointed out. Madam Chair, we will be giving you more detail as we walk through each of these individual clusters. My hope today was simply to give you some magnitude of where the large dollar amounts are, inflationary increases, mandated caseload increases, and what happens with the program reductions. So, Madam Chair, I'm open for questions.
George, I know that you and LFO staff and agency staff are working overtime on the budget and the figures, and I don't think that a lot of people in this building and people in the state really know the kinds of hours that our staff are putting in to this budget crisis. And I just want to thank all of you because I know that you're all really as concerned as we are and the citizens of this state with where we are. And it's not pretty. I think it's probably one of the most, Jean and I was talking earlier, one of the most difficult tasks that I think this committee has ever faced in the history that I've been in the state. Some might say, well, Gina and I must be communicating in the evenings that we both show up in our blues the next day. But it is one where we're all trying to work very closely. We're all, you know, very, very concerned about where we are with the state budget and what's coming down next. And I just wanted to personally say to all of our staff, to Sheila and Britton, and to all of you and George and Jean and your staff for all the time and the work that you're putting in to try to help us deal with this crisis and this problem. Last night we had our first meeting of the Oregon Health Plan Task Force, and I want to say at this time to welcome another new member who will be on that task force, and that's Ellen Lowe, who's in the audience there. The task force met last night, and I think we were encouraged that they understand the magnitude of the problems that we're facing and that they, you know, are willing to roll up their sleeves to help us to solve it. Tonight we will be having the mental health group that will be working, and Senator Gordley and Representative Bates is pulling double duty. For those of you who didn't know, he's having to work on both the one dock in the house is the spread. But I'm very, very grateful to all of you for your willingness to work and to set aside all of wherever we came from to work together to solve the problems for the citizens of the state. And I just had to put that on the record. It's I know how hard you're working. Did you want to have something to say, Representative Westland?
Just of the many august statements you've made from the center of this dais, Madam Chair, I think that is one of the most heartfelt and erudite that you've ever said, because we all know how hard the staff is working. And it's just not, you know, a numbers shortfall, it's a time shortfall. And we are all human beings and trying to deal with this in as collaborative a fashion as I've ever seen in this building. And between all of our very, very, very long hours of work, we are going to do this because it must be done. And you are a critical component to us arriving at the right answers. So thank you.
Thank you.
Just a quick comment, Madam Chair, since this has surfaced this morning or afternoon, whatever it is.
Serving on two groups.
We're making house calls tonight, right? Yeah. Okay. We're looking at somewhere in the neighborhood of over $1 billion in shortfall, or if you want to look at the possibility of what would cost to maintain something similar to our present program, close to a $2 billion shortfall for doing that.
That's in just one cluster, yeah. Representative Bates.
That's right. Huge amount of money. One thing that I've gained from this is that this is one of the times this body has come together. This is not a partisan situation. This is something that is very bipartisan, and everyone has been included in this, and I appreciate that. Being a member of the minority party, and that we've all worked together.
We don't talk that way on this committee.
Well, I'm going to make it very clear that in this committee you don't. You have made this into a bipartisan problem, and a bipartisan solution will be forthcoming. And I appreciate the people we're working with and the difficulty we're trying to do here. We don't want to walk away from $1 billion or more of matched funds, which we lose, but we may have to, and the program has to dramatically change to do that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Senator Shields, you're looking down there and very thoughtful.
I've been trying to be two places at once this afternoon because...
That's hard to do.
Yeah, the other committee that I'm on right now has been listening to descriptions of how the Oregon Health Plan works, and that Senate Health Policy Committee will end up weighing in on this whole issue, too. So I've been trying to be both places at once. But as soon as I came racing back here, and I hear you talking in very profound ways about the costs and so on and so forth. But if I might, since I have Jean sitting here, and now she's starting to hide under the desk, if I might, I'd like to talk to you about something. I mean, I know the costs are there, and I know they're great, and I know we've got to save money. But if you try to save money in the wrong way, you could end up costing yourself an arm and a leg. And I'm wondering about, for example, what you mentioned yesterday, and you used some generalizations because it's pretty hard to pin it down, but, you know, the state right now doesn't have money, and so we have some questions as to whether we'll be able to live up to our agreement in the Staley agreement. And because of that, I asked an expert in the field, and tell me if I'm wrong, and Madam Chairman, I'm going to describe this. It'll only take a minute or two. But the agreement between now and 2007 was supposedly to roll out some new services through various brokerages, 24-hour supported living services. So it's over three bienniums. But the state, in making the agreement, could not guarantee that the legislature could come up with the money. I mean, you know. So if you don't come up with the money, the possibilities exist that you go back to court. And I just want to move very quickly on this and say that the court can essentially say two things, because this is all under federal Medicaid law and the requirements of federal Medicaid law that services occur in a timely fashion. So what you have is a Staley agreement with a glide path. If we don't manage to live up to it all there, the court could say to the state, a deal's a deal, you've got to honor the deal you have, or the court could kind of get mad at us and decide to, quote-unquote, enforce Medicaid law. And I was talking to this person about this, an expert in the field, and that person said it could cost two or maybe even three times as much money if they decide to, quote-unquote, enforce Medicaid law. So you try to save money on the one hand, and it could end up biting you in a huge way on the other hand, and that, of course, affects everything that you're talking about with the Oregon Health Plan and all the other budgeting things.
Senator Schill, I think we will take all of those issues into consideration, recognizing that we do have, and both, and Dean and I talked about this, and we're very concerned about the Staley Agreement.
Well, that's just one.
That's just one, and we have others. Let me share, I was going to send this to you anyway, so let me share it to you with you anyway. I'd ask Senator, as you know, from time to time, I ask you all to help me, so this is really a bipartisan group that works here on this panel. I had asked Senator Carter to assist me in providing some guiding principles for us as we go through this budget. And I was going to mail this out to you, and I'll go ahead and share it with you now. As we go through the budget process, I want you to keep the following principles in mind. To protect Oregon's most vulnerable citizens first, particularly children and seniors, and those who are ill or disabled and poor, those least able to care for themselves. Address the problem of children early to avoid long-term costs. Prioritize access to basic health, including mental health care, and maintain a basic health infrastructure throughout the state, including public health clinics, emergency medical services, and hospitals. Maximize state general fund dollars by capturing federal matching funds where available and leveraging other funds where possible. Eliminate unnecessary duplication in service deliveries and maximize the state-local partnership to assure optimum program delivery. I think as we go through this and as we look at all of these issues, that this was to provide us with some framework on this panel with which to address the budget. It's the same kind of concepts that Representative Westland and Bates and some of us talked about when we as we deal with the Oregon Health Plan, as we deal with mental health. I think that we all know that we're going to have to get to a core place. Mm-hmm. And this core place is what this group, and as we run through this, I think we all recognize that in addition to the core place, that we do have litigation or legal entities that we also must include in these equations. And so that's our place. I've asked, like I asked last night, individuals, please come and tell us. We're open to where you have suggestions for efficiencies. We're welcome you on this ship. This is one group that is welcoming individuals on this ship to assist us as we row out. And like I said earlier, it is a tremendous task for this body and for the agency. And I think we all know that. And we're going to give it our best. I'm just really pleased at the cooperation that I have been receiving from everybody that serves with me on this committee and for the staff, LFO, and for, I'll say BAM so I can contribute to Rosie today. Rosie didn't get much in her bank today.
Yes.
So you were
Jim
good.
Jim paid, and Jim I did yesterday. So,
so anyway, I'm not going to belabor it. If you have no, Senator Gordley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you very much. I really appreciate the tenor and tone that you have set forth in guiding this committee and in including all of us in helping you to lead the way. We do have huge issues in front of us. But I would also say to us, and I appreciate that we are not the Revenue Committee. I understand that. But I also am mindful of the constituency I represent. And I think that given everything that has been said about our bipartisan approach and bipartisan opportunities, it would be my hope, that we find our way, our bipartisan way to tax reform, tax restructuring in our state. I say that reflecting on the fact that nearly every state in the nation is faced with a budget crisis of some degree or other. And none of the states, including our beloved state of Oregon, is going to find its way through to some other place without grappling with all the issues having to do with tax reform, tax restructuring. So again, it would be my hope at some point through the Revenue Committee process that as we, because the process that we're going through here is a very transparent one, we're revealing to the public the magnitude of the problem, the magnitude of the suffering. I would hope that as we do that, again, that we find our way as legislators and that we find our way as a state of citizens who love this state to do something to reform our tax structure. We're not going to find our way out of this unless we do that.
Okay. Any other questions? We will see you tomorrow.
You will see Ramona Foley.
And I will see Ramona Foley. And I tell her I look forward to the draw. And with that, we are adjourned till tomorrow at 1 p.m.